Are you guys, I couldn't even hear if you're breathing or not tonight. You're really quiet. You're really quiet tonight. I hope you did get a glance at the sunset John just mentioned to us. And hope you've had a good day. I hope everybody found out last night that your furnace works okay. If you didn't, you got chilly probably. I hope you also get to see some of the beauty of God's good world during this time of the year. We welcome you to our class. If you are a guest tonight with us, if you're here with family, we really thank you for joining us also this evening. We are at a great place in our study of a wonderful part of the New Testament. We've given Hebrews the theme yesterday and today and forever, from Hebrews 13 and verse 8, and we're trying to think about the mystery of this book, in the sense that this book especially confronts the secular outlook of our culture these days. It has done so by talking to us about timeless things, about unseen things, about spiritual things, and about a God who exists on his own, apart from the created order, and yet he's involved in the world that he's made. So in that way, this book makes us really stop and think. Now, I'd like for us to kind of get our bearings with where we are right now. So please remember that at the end of chapter 2, the writer made the point that Jesus became like his brothers in all things, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest. His work as high priest is going to be the great theme of this book. This says he's a merciful and faithful high priest, and the writer helps us think about his faithfulness first. So the faithfulness of Jesus is the issue here. Now, please notice three landmarks in chapter 3 with where we are for a moment. Everybody look with me. Verse 1 makes the point that we are, as brothers and sisters in Christ, we are partakers of a heavenly calling. Everybody notice what we're partakers. We're partakers of a heavenly calling. Then verse 6, we are his house. Christ was faithful as the Son over his house. Whose house are we? So we are partakers of a family, partakers of a household. And then look at verse 14. We have become partakers of Christ. So of a heavenly calling, of his house, his household, and then partakers of Christ. But now look back at those three verses with me a second, and notice that the conditional nature of these statements is implied. Verse 1 calls us to consider the apostle and high priest of our confession. To consider meaning to take notice of him in order to imitate him or to be like him. To consider him as the reality and let that fashion our thinking and our outlook. Verse 6 says we're his house if we hold firmly to our confidence. And then verse 14 is going to say that we've become partakers of Christ if we keep the beginning of our confidence firm to the end. So that if is what is at stake in most of the thinking of this discussion in chapters 3 and 4. Essential to it is the fact, the idea that Jesus is, as a son, faithful in a way that Moses, as great as he was and as faithful as he was, could not be. Moses was faithful as a servant in the house. Christ is faithful as the Son over the house. Having made that point, then the writer has contrasted for us the followers or the people led by Moses and the people who led by Jesus. He has said the people who were present with Moses did not imitate his faithfulness. They fell in the wilderness. The people who are followers of Jesus, well, that's us who read this letter with the intention to take it to heart, and that's what he's asking us to decide. Notice the quote again. Those of you who are in the Sunday part of this discussion were with us. We tried to read and think about the statement that he quotes from Psalm 95, verses 7 through 11 in Hebrews 3. The first word is important in this discussion, today. The last word is important in this discussion, rest. And in between is what causes people to miss out on the rest. What is that? Well, hardness of heart. The hardness of heart that causes people to see everything that God does for them and gives to them and says to them and not learn a thing from it and then rebel from against God and provoke Him and rebel and not follow Him into the land of promise. Now, I want to read this section with you for a second. We'll not get to think about everything in it. This is a great letter. This is the second of the important exhortations of Hebrews. This one is a very thought-provoking one, and it really causes us to stop and think. It says, "Take care, brothers and sisters, that there will not be, or lest there be, in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart." Or some versions will say, an evil heart of unbelief. "In falling away from the living God. But exhort or encourage one another day by day, as long as it is called today, so that none of you will be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ if we keep the beginning of our commitment or our confidence firm until the end, while it is said," or as it is said, "today, if you hear His voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me," or when they rebellion, some of the versions will say. "For who provoked Him when they had heard? Indeed, did not all those who came out of Moses, or out of Egypt, led by Moses? And with whom was He angry for 40 years? Was He provoked for 40 years? Was it not those who sinned, whose dead bodies fell in the wilderness? And to whom did He swear that they would not enter His rest, but to those who were disobedient? And so we see that they were not able to enter because of unbelief. Therefore, we must fear if, while a promise remains of entering His rest, any one of you may seem to have come short of it. For indeed, we have had good news preached to us, just as they also did. But the word they heard did not benefit them." And you'll notice the translation difference here. They're two different. There's a manuscript variations. "Either because they were not united with those who listened with faith, or because it was not united with faith and those who heard, or who to whom this good news was preached." Now, let's think about the phrases in this whole passage, and and try to take the encouragement from it or the urging from it, I think that it wants to offer to us. What do you see as the big danger that the writer is warning us about in this passage? Unbelief. Bottom line is unbelief. Where does he start though? What is his big concern, not only in the quote from Psalm 95, but also in this passage? It's that, pardon? Right, that none of you be hardened. That's the idea, that none of, and I want to put it up here so we can think about this, that none of you, and actually it's not just our hearts that he's talking about, but our whole way of life, our whole being, our whole personality, our whole selves. In the Old Testament, who would be your leading example of someone whose heart was hardened? Pharaoh. We think of the Egyptian Pharaoh. And remember how his heart became hardened? What did God do to harden old Pharaoh's heart in the time when he was wanting to bring his people out? Did God just zap him so that he had no choice and there was no way he could respond and there was no opportunity for him to respond? What did God do that hardened the king of Egypt's heart? He did that. But every time, though, before he sent a plague, he did something else. Remember, he sent Moses. What do you have Moses to tell Pharaoh? Let my people go. Why did that harden his heart?
Well, he had all that free labor.
Maybe he didn't want to lose his workers. That came up later on for sure. But actually, he said something. Remember? Gene says his ego or his pride. And Becky, what were you going to say? All right. He did not want to be submissive to... Right, Jan. That's what I was getting at here. Remember the first time Moses walks in there and says, "Thus says the Lord, let my people go." And Pharaoh said, "Who's the Lord that I should listen to him?" And that happens, and then the plague starts, and then Moses goes back in and says, "Thus says the Lord, let my people go," and he gets more stubborn, and then it goes through the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and he backs himself farther and farther into a corner, and becomes more and more proud, and more arrogant, and more stubborn. So in the view of the writer of Hebrews, that can happen to any of us, I think. And to him, it seems like the issue boils down to a couple of things. And it will be, he keeps repeating this. Did you notice this? Today, if you hear his voice, then what? Harden not your heart. So I want for us to consider here, what is he thinking here? Why is the today a crucial thing here? How do you get from hearing his voice to hardening your heart? You don't do anything about what you hear today. You either put it off, or you reject it, and then you go through that again, and you go through that again, and you go through that again, and the farther and farther you go, the less impression anything God says actually makes on you. So the Hebrew writer's idea is the big issue in not letting your heart be hardened is what you do about what you hear from the Lord today. And I noticed that in this context, the writer uses the word today 8 times, trying to really drive home that point or to emphasize that point. Now, his idea of the hard heart is something that maybe we should investigate a little bit more while we are here about this. I think it's parallel in this passage. Hardening your heart, rebelling against God, provoking God, putting God to the test, going astray or erring in your heart, not knowing God's way. I'm citing some of the phrases from verses 7 through 11. And then on down through this passage, notice the parallels here. There's the evil, unbelieving heart, which we'll mention in a second from verse 12. Then there is the falling away from the living God, also at the end of verse 12. Then there's being hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Then there is not holding firm to the end, and so forth. So you can see that he's talking about a whole issue. Now, what forms does this process of hardening take in our experience? Being used to hearing, being bored by hearing, putting off doing anything about what is heard, rejecting what is heard, completely doing the opposite of what God has said, all those things begin to take a toll on a person. That's the way the writer of Hebrews says it. And I brought a quote that I want to share with you here. This is from a writer named Hawthorne, a commentator named Hawthorne. He observes that verses 12 and 13 together, and that's the where we started reading a while ago, the take care, lest there be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart. They describe a process which happens deep within a man when there is not the constant strengthening of mutual exhortation or encouragement from fellow Christians, a process which initially is invisible to any observer. First, the germ of unbelief is allowed to sprout. Then evil and God-defying thoughts begin to spread. These gradually dominate the entire attitude until the whole character is changed. A new tendency is in control of the person involved. His basic response to God is no. There is now no longer the yes of submission which he professed at his baptism. The point he's making is that this doesn't happen all at once like it may sometimes appear to do. It is a process. And the way it happens is, he says, the key issue of hardening is the deceitfulness of sin. End of verse 13. What is there about sin which is deceitful? What does he mean by that, do you think? Sin is the either the missing of the mark or the going astray, that idea. This is a purposeful thing. In this case, it's not an individual sin. It's the whole way of life that's talked about. What is there that's deceitful about it? All right. It's deceitful in that what you hear is itself a lie or a misleading thing. Yes. So
when the devil tempted Adam and Eve, told them they wouldn't. Well, he told them about God's.
All right. It just leaves the wrong impression. Then you look at what is forbidden, and then it looks good to you, and it seems like it would really make you look good, and it seems like it would really make you smart or sophisticated, and then you just do it. What's deceitful is that it promises something it can't deliver, then it blinds, and then it leaves you ruined. Say it again. All right. Right. And that's all the way from Pharaoh to the sun god, to the god that was supposed to be in the Nile, to all the right, all of the naturalistic or human-based things that are still often troubling us. And what happens here is the deceitfulness of sin can gradually take over until it finally hardens a person and that person falls away from God. Please notice that in this whole context, the writer's attention is on the individual believer, on any one of you. He says that twice in this passage. He's interested in the whole people of God, but this is an exhortation that has to do with any one of us, and that is in verse 12 and in chapter 4 and verse 2, which is why I read, or verse 1, which is why I read the whole section here. Now, if you think about this, you may think, well, that would never happen to any one of us who are here, right? So the writer tries to make his point that this is an urgent danger and a real danger. And the way he makes the point, if you notice, is by using the experience of that generation that was delivered from bondage in Egypt and then fell in the wilderness, right? So notice, skip down here to verse 15 and following, and I'm going to come back to the other in just a minute, don't worry. But he says, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me. And now notice the questions that come up here. He makes his point, verses 16 through 18, by asking three questions and then answering his three questions with questions. The first question in verse 16 is who? For who provoked? Do you notice that? You see that? Who provoked him when they had heard? The answer, another question. What is the question that answers? All right, didn't they all? That's my way of trying to illustrate his point here. So this would be first question, verse 16. And you may think to yourself, well, no, Joshua and Caleb didn't. But you get his point, don't you? A whole generation of people who were delivered from bondage ended up with a fate that missed out on the promise. Then second question, verse 17, is what? With whom was he angry? With whom was he provoked? All right. With whom was he provoked? And the question that the answers that was it not with those who sinned, whose dead bodies fell in the wilderness? So I won't write that all up here, but you see the point. Obviously, the fact that they fell in the wilderness indicating that they had chosen sin and that they had spent this whole 40 years rebelling against him, as we read in the passage Sunday. And therefore God was provoked with him. And then verse 18, to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest? And again, I won't write it all, but you get the idea. Who provoked him? They all did. With whom was he provoked? That whole generation fell in the wilderness. All the ones whose dead bodies fell there. And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest? And the answer is, all right, those who were disobedient, he says. But to those who were disobedient. And this translation doesn't pose the two questions, but they are there in that third case. So the point is, who out of God's people who have been delivered from bondage, who can be hardened, end up in a state of unbelief, and be so disobedient that they fall to sin in the wilderness and don't make it to the promised land? Who? Any one of us. And how do you know that? Because it's happened before. That's the idea. And you say, well, that's the difference between Moses and Christ, Moses' generation and the people of Christ. And that's true. But the point that the Hebrew writer is making, we follow a more faithful leader, and the standard for us is not less faithfulness than that generation in the wilderness. He knows we're not perfect and we're still people, which is why we need a merciful high priest. But the point is, we follow the leadership also of a faithful high priest. Now, let me remove some of this so we can think farther. How do we avoid that danger? How do we overcome it? This is a word of encouragement. This whole book is. He's not trying to make us think it's hopeless and useless. So let's see what he says to do. First off, take care, brothers and sisters. What does that mean? Take care. Watch out. Pay attention. Take heed. Usually we say when we're saying something, that we're bidding a good day or something, or we're saying goodbye to someone we love, we say, take care. You know, and that means to be careful today. And that sort of, so that's part of it. Then that there not be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart. So let me just mention here are the dangers. Evil, unbelieving heart. That's the danger, first danger here. And then the second way this is described, please notice here at the end of verse 18, disobedient. And then at the end of verse 19, they were not able to enter in because of unbelief. Are those three different things? This is the heart. This is the response of the will. And this is the state of being. This is not absence of enough facts to believe. This is the unbelief idea of rebellion. Now, on the other hand, the options he presents for us in verses 12 and 13 and 14 are present. Please notice here for a few minutes here. So that there is not that kind of heart in falling away from the living God, which we tried to show Sunday is something that can happen. What can we do? What does he say in verse 13? This is the take heed part of it, or take care. We've already said that. What? All right. He says exhort one another, or this version that I'm reading says encourage one another. But the idea is exhort one another. Call one another to your side. Call them and put your arm around them and move forward in that way. Encourage one another. What does it mean to encourage one another? Does it mean, oh, good job, or everything will be all right, or what does it mean to encourage each other this way? This is a mutual act, but what does it actually mean here?
Build up.
What's he doing? What's he saying? He's trying to call us all the way to the end, to be faithful all the way to the end. To encourage means to give each other reason to hang in there and to give each other confidence that it can be done. That's the idea, to deepen one another's confidence. When do we exhort one another? Day by day. Why is that important, given the means in which hardening can occur? Why is this day by day important? Right?
It's a slow process from day to day.
It's a slow process that way. It's a slow process the other way. I raced up here. Remember, today, if you hear his voice, harden not your heart. Encouragement means today, listen to his voice. Right? This is encouragement day by day is the antidote to the tendency to forget to listen to God any day. Phil.
I think Satan works that way.
Oh, that's a good point. He doesn't take days off, does he? Yeah. And if you didn't hear what he says important to remember, because Satan works day by day too. And so if, on the one hand, the credit given to the power of encouragement is present here. On the other hand, the fact that it needs to be the actual putting your arm around someone's shoulder and say, let's listen to the Lord and not to the other stuff we hear in the world around us today. Let's listen to the Lord. Then the next thing he says is, Do this, encourage each other. This writer makes a big point, I think, of being of the importance of Christians being together so that this can happen. We'll see that again in this book. And then in verse 14, the reason is my title up here, for we have become partakers of Christ. Now, given what we've tried to say here about the comparison between Christ and Moses, and then the contrast between the people of Moses and the people of Christ, what significance does this have? He's encouraging us in saying this, The people who Moses led out of Egypt, what happened to them? They all fell in the wilderness. The ones who were of Moses did that. We, however, are not of Moses, of Moses' faithfulness. We are of Christ. We are partakers of Christ. So what he's saying is, remember that we are followers of a Son who listened to the Father day by day and was faithful as a son. We're God's, it addresses us as brothers and sisters. Verse 12. We're God's children. We're his house. We're obligated to listen to the Father like our Lord did. And we are partakers of Christ if what? Verse 14, if, say it loudly,
hold our confidence.
If we hold our confidence. Now, I learned in working on this that the word for confidence in this verse here is different from the word confidence that we've already run across in this chapter in verse 6. There the word meant our kind of our boasting or our glorying in our confidence in that way. Here it is more our commitment. That, in fact, that's the way the New American Standard Version translates this. We started out with the good confession and with the confidence that was committed and was firm, and then life starts working on us, and days go by, and we get used to this, and we find out the challenges that are present, and this writer is saying, look, it was that way with the Lord who was faithful too. Remember, just tell me the story of Jesus, the things that song says he went through. We are his people. Let's keep the beginning of our commitment firm until the end. And that idea, the end, is going to be, until the end, is going to be, if you notice chapter 4 and verses 1 and 2, it's going to be rest. Now, the contrast with the two peoples is sharpest in that point. They did not keep their confidence. They kept saying, let's go back to Egypt. They fell in the wilderness. If we hold fast our confidence firm to the end, it means there is rest for us to enter. We're going to talk about the gospel of rest in our session with the class on Sunday. For now, I want you to notice verse 19. So we see that they were not able to enter because of unbelief. Everybody notice that? Now, here's a quote I found that made me stop and think. The author does not say that they did not enter, but that they were not able to enter. Sin is self-defeating, and unbelief of itself prevents us from entering God's rest. This is not an arbitrary penalty imposed by a despotic God. It's the inevitable outcome of unbelief. And I think that's an important point. In the original language, the final word in this section of the argument, which is at the end of the sentence, is no faith, no belief. It's the absence of belief. That's what robbed the wilderness generation of the rest that they had every reason to expect when they came out of Egypt. And the point is, let's not let that happen to us. Our job is to see to it that neither one of us falls to unbelief or disobedience or to hardening of heart. What kind of encouragement does it take to let us overcome in that way? There's much more in this passage that hopefully will give us maybe at least a place to start in thinking about it. Gene, would you mind to stand and lead us in a prayer before we go tonight? Thank you, Gene. Everybody have a good rest of the week.